This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to this episode of LGIM Talks. I'm Max Julius. With the benefit of hindsight, 2019 was a year when investors could simply sit back and bask in the fantastic returns delivered by a broad sweep of asset classes. Of course, it's never that straightforward in real time, and such years are extremely rare. So investors of all types need to weigh numerous factors when considering how to create a robust portfolio that can meet their needs in a variety of market conditions. Well, I'm delighted to be joined by two people who've been giving serious thought to the principles of portfolio construction, so this very issue. Will Riley, Head of Solutions at LGIM, and Tim Dougal, Head of Investment Advisory. Will and Tim, welcome to the pod.
Cheers, Max. Thank you.
It's a bit like your fitness coaches or personal trainers for a portfolio, as it were, and you try to get that portfolio into the right shape, match fit, to reach its objectives, if that at all makes sense.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it's about, you could take it, you're the person who's coming in at face value and say, yeah, you know, they want to get bigger biceps, or they want to just, you know, go to the gym and get bigger muscles. But at the heart of that, they might be actually trying to address something that might be more fitness oriented, it might be health oriented, and that's what we're trying to diagnose. We're trying to work with a client to really understand what are those real sort of core challenges that they have, and try and address those rather than what is the superficial, you know, on the face of it could be the answer to their problem.
Now, you've put together within the team a framework to look at the principles for portfolio construction. What exactly does this do, and why did you develop it?
Okay. So we were seeing a lot of our clients struggling with complexity of building portfolios. There's a lot of moving parts in portfolios, and you do really need to think about it all together to build an efficient portfolio, but that's not very helpful. So we wanted to make it easier for our clients to build portfolios that were right for them and help them to join all the different pieces together. We saw clients not really focusing on their actual objectives and getting lost in the detail sometimes, thinking about picking managers or thinking about, you know, one particular issue, spending a long time on that and really not making sure that the overall portfolio was the right fit for them.
It's about taking that kind of big picture, holistic view that Will outlined earlier in terms of the team's overall approach.
I think that's exactly right. I think there's times when the client comes to you and you think you're dealing with a certain type of problem we're trying to manage because that's what they believe it is. And you often need a framework that can actually go through what their investment beliefs are, how they think about how the portfolio has been structured. And once you've gone through that with them, you actually realize it might have been something different that you might actually needed to address up front.
Right. So how would different types of investors use the principles in practice?
Yeah, it actually is quite suitable to a number of different investors. What we find is that investors have these different beliefs and objectives, and they might have completely different portfolios. So getting clarity around what is important to them and what they are trying to achieve, and fundamentally how you believe you'll be able to do this is very important up front. But the different steps are, you know, they're applicable to everyone from, you know, whether it's an individual investor to an institutional investor, whether it's an insurance company or a pension fund. You know, for example, an individual investor, you know, saving for themselves, you know, they would be considering all these additional assets and care costs that they will have in old age. Whereas, you know, something like a DB pension scheme would also have to be thinking more broadly about the different costs and implications that they would have.
Right. So, Tim, what are the specific steps that Will refers to within the framework, and are any of those, or which ones of those do you think are most commonly overlooked in portfolio construction?
Sure. So there's 8 steps in the framework, and the idea of this framework is that it tries to bring together the whole portfolio construction process and allow clients to look at it step by step, work through it. And you can also drill down in each of the different areas to get into much more detail as well. Now, there's lots of things you can invest your money in, but that doesn't mean that they're all a good idea. So you want to find investment opportunities that have a good reason why they should generate a return in future. So an identifiable economic rationale, a behavioral explanation, or some structural reason, and ideally a good track record as well. First, you need to find the things, then you can start building them into a portfolio. And then step 8 is about, fine, you built your portfolio, but it's not a static thing. You need to make sure that it remains appropriate. You need to adapt to market conditions.
I mean, a classic example there is also ESG, where, you know, people think they can go in and just look and try and actually change a manager within their setup, where what they should actually be doing is trying to take that all the way back to thinking more broadly, you know, what are my investment beliefs and how they are they changing? If you're going to be more socially aware, what does that mean for the rest of your portfolio? And then to actually roll that down into your asset allocation and all the various steps that then flow from it to have a more holistic view on what you're trying to do rather than just actually attacking it in a manager selection context.
Liquidity management is increasingly an area of focus for investors. How can we compare the scope for predictable and unpredictable liquidity requirements against the expected and potential availability of that market liquidity?
Sure. So, yeah, liquidity management or cash flow management, making sure that you've actually got enough cash to pay out, is increasingly important. It's getting a lot of focus in a lot of different areas for a lot of different investors, actually. So, you know, we're seeing this in the news at the moment about property funds, open-ended property funds. Are they liquid enough? And personal investors investing in funds and finding that, you know, that they don't have the liquidity when they might need it.
Right, unlisted stocks as well.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Yeah. So from an individual investor's standpoint and sort of the retail investment side, people are concerned about illiquidity that they don't want in their portfolios. But then on the flip side, if you look at institutional investors, and I work with a lot of pension schemes, actually often they say, well, we do have quite a long investment time horizon and we can tolerate more illiquidity in our portfolio. So we'd like some of that, please, but we want to make sure we get rewarded for it. So, you know, people are coming at it from different angles. But you see both of those situations, again, it's a question of what's right for you, and it's about comparing what your liquidity needs are. So if you're an individual investor and you know, you actually do need that cash in the short term, maybe you don't have a tolerance for lots of illiquidity, or if it's an open-ended fund, does it really have the tolerance for it? But if you're a pension scheme, then maybe you can access more of that. So the challenge here about when you're building a portfolio is really checking how illiquid is the asset that you're investing in, and how much liquidity do you really need? Don't just test it in a best case scenario though as well. Think about the stress scenarios. Think about what could go wrong, what's predictable, what's unpredictable.
I think there's also, I mean, I'd also add to that in terms of other considerations, especially in the form of derivatives, where market events can actually cause massive cash flows on your portfolio that you need to be aware of. And so, you know, a classic one is, you know, sterling and currency hedge, where you might have thought that you're managing your offshore exposure well and got a lot of hedges in place. But then if something happens to sterling and you end up having then to suddenly make available a large amount of cash, you've got to then be considerate of what's inside your portfolio and what you can redeem at quite, you know, quite a quick notice in order to make sure you can cover a lot of those FX. So there's a lot of thoughts that you need to give to the type of asset profile and how quickly you can actually, you know, materialize those assets in order to meet short-term liquidity requirements.
Well, that leads us on very nicely to a question around tail risk, and just thinking about sterling and market events. Of course, we've had the Brexit process of late, thinking about geopolitical risk. And just at the beginning of this year, there's the drama in the Middle East as well. So why is it important for investors to conduct scenario analysis and seek to mitigate tail risks? And how can they actually do so in practice?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really important that we build portfolios that are robust and that we're not relying too heavily on a quantitative model to set where the targets are for an investment. We saw this in during the financial crisis, where you know there were these fixed assumptions that you build into the model that introduced a lot of fragility into the portfolio construction process. So we want to be able to test that portfolios will offer some sort of reasonable performance, but you also want to make sure that this happens in extreme scenarios. And so,
right, because those assumptions sometimes are proven incorrect.
It's the difference between risk and uncertainty. You know, you can say, "Oh, yeah, I accept risk. I know the markets move," but some things are just fundamentally unpredictable, and that's uncertainty. And you just need to recognize that your assumptions are going to be wrong. And because your assumptions are going to be wrong, you can't say, "Well, this portfolio works in all these scenarios." You've got to say, "Okay, what could go wrong?" And so you maybe don't have the best portfolio, but maybe you'll accept that there, as long as it's good enough in a lot of different scenarios, then actually that's probably a better outcome. And if you think about the case of pension schemes, for example, the really bad scenario for a pension scheme is where the sponsor covenant where the sponsor's in trouble. And you know, so if the sponsor's gone bust and then your pension scheme at that point in time, the assets are performing poorly, well, that's just a really bad situation to be in. You'd probably take bad performance in a situation where the sponsor's doing okay, but in this scenario, you really can't tolerate it.
Some of the innovative analysis that our team has done is actually looked at that volatility in terms of the scheme sponsor and its credit rating relative to your overall portfolio construction, and therefore try to adjust what your target required return needs to be from the scheme. And I think that's been quite really interesting to see that impact in terms of what you really need to achieve from your assets in order to get to the right return, taking into account that covenant.
Let's look at another example of the framework in use in practice with regard to endgame portfolio construction for DB pension schemes. Tim, could you perhaps talk a little bit through that?
Yeah, sure. So this is quite a nice case of how you can use the framework to examine what you're going to do for your portfolio. So if you're a pension scheme, start with step one: establish investment beliefs. Sometimes people aren't clear that they have investment beliefs, but most people do. You know, most people, you know, if you say to them, "Why are you investing in equities? Why are you investing in bonds?" It's because they fundamentally believe that those asset classes will give a return. You know, they're not going down the bookies. They're not putting their money on the horses. So there are some fundamental beliefs that a lot of people have, but you need to examine those, because sometimes you can have a bias and you might find that you build that into your portfolio without recognizing it. So start with that. Make sure that, and if there's a group of you making a decision, as there will be on a trustee board, just make sure everyone's on the same page. So you're starting with that. But then it gets really interesting here in the end game portfolio for talking about the objectives. So what are you actually trying to achieve? And we say the end game as if it's one thing, but actually pension schemes will probably be trying to do different things. Some schemes will be aiming for a long-term runoff, so they might call that self-sufficiency. They want to run the scheme for a long time. They don't want to rely on the sponsor. They have a very long time horizon. They can afford maybe to tolerate a bit of short-term volatility. Other schemes will be actually aiming for buyout with an insurance company. So for them, actually, the time horizon isn't as long. And they, they need to invest really to match insurer prices, and for a relatively short time horizon if they can do it in the next few
years. Right, and just to clarify for our listeners, that's when the sponsor just hands over its liabilities and assets, yeah, to the insurance company, yeah, for at a price.
Yes, that's right. Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's one of the things where I think Algem really has a competitive advantage in that we're agnostic to whatever that outcome is for the client. If we're thinking in those situations, if a client wants to have the ability to, you know, to have that self-sufficiency style portfolio, we can help manage some of the assets to get them there. But if they're also wanting to understand how to get, you know, take the next steps that are necessary to go into buy-in, we are able to help them with those steps and in that transition period facilitate that into buy-in for them. So we've obviously got a lot of experience in working with schemes in terms of how we do that. And I think we're in a really strong, unique position in order to manage those transitions for clients.
Staying with portfolio construction for Endgame. Are there any other points, Tim, you'd like to draw out?
Every step of the framework is relevant there, but there's probably a few really interesting ones to pull out. Step two, this focus on objectives, is pretty critical for the end game. Are you trying to achieve buyout with an insurer, or are you aiming for long-term runoff? Your objective there was going to determine how your portfolio is built. The rest of the steps around finding investment opportunities, diversifying, protecting against risks, equally relevant, but maybe the interesting one is liquidity. And as we discussed before, this idea of if you're aiming for long-term runoff particularly, then you've got a lot more scope for holding liquid assets in your portfolio. And so this could be things like secure income investments where you're getting a pretty good yield on those and really you're trying to access the liquidity premium.
In addition, for secure income, we have really strong experience of understanding what assets are required for buy-in. And so having that knowledge of what assets will be able to pass through to the insurer, again, addresses this challenge that a lot of funds are facing, where they're thinking about buy-in but want to make sure that they're have enough liquidity within their portfolios and now need to try and design their asset allocation or design the right optimal set of assets that will help them get into buying in the cheapest and most efficient possible way.
Right, and just to clarify for our listeners, buying is where the insurer covers a proportion of the scheme's liabilities, but not all of them.
And there you're sort of getting into the constraints angle of that you know, there's regulatory constraints on what insurers can actually hold and what they can invest in. So you need to understand those constraints if you're trying to invest in assets that the insurers are going to want.
Right. And just going back to the step where you clarify objectives and constraints, I mean, would you ever, when working with a client, say, unfortunately, you know, we understand what you'd like to do here, but it's just frankly not possible?
Yeah, well, we work pretty closely with our clients to help them set their objectives. So part of that is understanding their circumstances and then giving them advice on these are the range of objectives that you could consider. So, you know, sometimes clients might say, well, I want to hit a really high return target, or I want to get to buyout in 3 years. And you can say, well, yeah, we could target that, but you would bring in other risks. You bring in liquidity risks. You bring in all of these other points, which you just need to consider that as well. So we would always try and give our clients the full picture.
Finally, I understand that this the framework and the principles are something of a work in progress. How do you plan to evolve it going forward?
Our framework is already well established internally, but we plan to communicate more of our thinking externally over the coming year. If clients would like to know more in the meantime, though, they should get in touch, and we would be happy to share our views and thoughts around the portfolio construction process. Any new research we're doing will be delivered in this framework too. So we're thinking more about secure income and some products that will be launched later this year, as well as endgame portfolios, specifically around, you know, the types of portfolios you need to help either go to self-sufficiency or to go to buy-in. And so we'll hopefully be working closer with the clients and sharing more of these insights later.
Well, that's a great point to finish up on. Thank you both very much for joining us today for this fascinating discussion, which has ranged from the problem with assumptions to sponsor risk and liquidity management. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To read more about the team's framework, which is outlined in the concluding section of our CIO 2020 Outlook, click on the link in the show notes or visit elgim.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.